Good morning.
I really love it.
Good morning. I'll call to order the Agriculture and Food Finance and Policy Division. Welcome back, everyone. We are set to rock and roll here. We've got lots of things to do in a short amount of time over the course of the next couple of months, but I'm glad to see everybody back. We do have, just at the beginning here, we have a couple of minutes. Packets are in the packets, and we need to approve those. So I'm going to, Representative Brand, the first set were the ones from 2019, actually.
Yep, I'll move the minutes, Madam Chair, from May 22nd, 2019.
Thank you. And the reason why we have these, May 22nd, 2019, this was a review of what the bill was going to be, the finance bill, and we did it. It was after regular session, kind of when we were in that limbo period before we actually went to the floor with it. So is there any corrections, additions? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. The motion prevails. Those minutes are adopted. And then Representative Brand.
Madam Chair, I move the minutes from January 27th, 2020.
Thank you. And those are the minutes that we had for our meeting that we held right before this session began, when we talked a lot about climate change and what the department was doing, and had a pretty comprehensive day of meeting. Any corrections, additions to those minutes? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. The motion prevails. Those minutes are adopted. Thank you very much. Today we are kind of going back into knowing what we have accomplished over the interim, and it maybe is less about us and more about the people that are going to be presenting, obviously, because they're the ones that did some work. We might have encouraged them to do some of that work, so we're happy to be able to hear about it. So we're going to hear from the Department of Ag on dairy, the D-A-I-R-I program, the hemp rules and how hemp has blossomed, and emerging farmers. And then also today we are fortunate to hear from the Center for Rural Policy and Development. They've been working on some things as well, and so we're excited to hear from them. But before we begin, we do have people in the audience that are from Minnesota Farmers Union. It is their day on the Hill, so they, as many of them that could, that came through the weather, were able to come today, and we appreciate that they're in the audience. So thank you for being here. So we're going to start with MDA. We've got Ashley Bress and Anthony Cordelet. We're going to be talking about information on the dairy program. And just a reminder from people, we did fund a big significant portion of that out of the ag budget, but we also had some money from the Jobs and Economic Development Finance Committee. And so we wanted to hear from the department about hopefully the success of that, the number of participants in it, and how that was really rolled out and what was done with that. So we'll start with Ashley and hear from about that. So welcome to the committee, and just introduce yourself, and then you can go ahead and begin your presentation.
All right, great. Thank you. My name is Ashley Bress. I supervise the grants team at in the Ag Marketing and Development Division. In that capacity, I'm responsible for a number of the agri programs, including the Dairy Assistance Investment and Relief in Initiative, which we often refer to as Dairy with an I. As you may recall, near the end of the last legislative session, you provided this program for us to administer through the agri bill. Through that bill, you provided us with three main parameters for the program. The first being that producers who are eligible for this program must enroll for 5 years of coverage under the Federal Dairy Margin Coverage Protection Program that's operated through USDA's Farm Service Agency. You also limited enrollment to producers or farms that produce less than 160,000 heavyweight of milk in 2018. This is roughly the equivalent of about 750 cows. You also told us that we had the ability to base payments based on about 50 or based on 50,000 heavyweight of milk that was produced in 2018. This is roughly the equivalent of about 232 cows. Also, through that ag bill, you provided funding for the program. Through the fiscal year 2020 to 2021 Agri budget rider, you gave us the authority to use up to $5 million out of Agri for this. Through the jobs bill, an additional $3 million was provided for transfer to the MDA for the program. Both of these funds are one-time funding, only available to us in fiscal year 2020. All together, this means that we had a budget of about $8 million for the program. Based upon that $8 million appropriation and what we know about dairy farms in Minnesota, such as the size of them and the number of them, we determined that if all eligible producers enrolled in the program, we would be able to confidently issue checks immediately based upon 10 cents per hundredweight. So based upon that 50,000 hundredweight maximum, that means in that first round, the maximum check could be for $5,000. After we completed the first round, we've come to the determination that we can issue a second round of checks based upon 13 cents per hundredweight. So that second maximum check is going to be for $6,500, but I'll talk more about that in a moment. A little bit about our timeline. As you may recall, this program came together pretty quickly at the end of the legislative session. We were able to open the application before the end of fiscal year 19, so in the middle of June, we got the application open. We worked very, very closely with industry partners and our friends at the USDA Farm Service Agency to put this together and make it as easy as possible on our farmers. Through that application, we asked our producers to submit four pretty simple things to us. A one-page dairy with an I app application, a copy of their DMC enrollment form that they would get from their local FSA office, a copy of their 2018 production record from their milk processors, and then a copy of their W-9 so that we could get them set up in the state's vendor system. Soon after the start of the fiscal year and those funds were made available to us, we were able to start issuing payments. That was the middle of July. We closed the application process on October 8th. We did extend this once from October 1st because USDA extended their enrollment deadline as well. Our first round payments were completed by November 4th, so anybody who had submitted a complete application was paid by that point. It was around that same time that we were starting to realize that there were a number of dairy producers who intended to enroll in the program, but for one reason or another, we're not able to, whether they simply forgot, they didn't have a complete application in, or one thing or another. So at the end of December, we reopened the application period for just 2 weeks. With the understanding that those producers who applied during that period of time would only be eligible for the second payment. And then I'm happy to report that about a week ago, we have started to issue second round payments. So far, we've been able to issue, or within the next couple of days, right around 180 of those. So going back to round one a little bit, we had just about 1,800 producers get involved there. Those producers represent about 1,550 farms. So that can be a little bit confusing or like why that discrepancy is there. But we have a number of farms that enrolled in DMC with two parties involved on that single policy form. So that might be a situation of a husband and wife. It might be a grandfather, father, and a son who are all farming together. So in which case their payments were split accordingly. It's also interesting to note that for many of these producers, this was their first time having a financial transaction with the state, which is why we needed those W-9s. And we had to get probably most of those producers set up in the state's accounting systems. All told, we issued just about $3.4 million in payments to those 1,800 producers. Our minimum check was just about $26, so a fairly small farm there. And our maximum checks were $5,000. And again, that's based upon the 10% or the 10 cents per hundredweight up to 50,000 hundredweight. And our average check amount was just under $1,900 in the first round. As I mentioned, we reopened enrollment for round two the end of December. All of those producers who successfully enrolled in round one were not required to submit any additional paperwork, but we wanted to make sure that those producers who missed out had one final opportunity to do so. Before issuing second payments, we have verified producers' enrollment or five-year enrollment in the Dairy Margin Coverage Protection Program. Again, FSA has been wonderful to work with throughout this. We expect that our total round two payments are going to be about $4.5 million. And again, that's based upon 13 cents per hundredweight. All told, we expect our payments between round one and round two to be about $7.9 million of that $8 million that was made available to us. One quick example of what this might look like for a producer, if this in this mock example, we have a producer who produced, you know, 50,000 hundredweight of milk in 2018. In round one, they would have received a payment of $5,000. In round two, they can look forward to receiving a payment of $6,500. So that farm would receive a total payment of $11,500, which is the maximum any single farm can receive. We are in the process of issuing those second payments, and we hope to have those completed in the next, like, probably 6 to 8 weeks or so. With that, thank you for the opportunity to talk with you about dairy, and I'm happy to take any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Bress. We do have some questions. So, Representative Poston.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mrs. Bress, I'm looking back a couple of pages. It says round one metrics on the top. And you show participating producers 1,800 and participating farms 1,550. Can you kind of explain that?
Sure. Madam Chair, Representative, that goes back to how producers chose to enroll in DMC. The DMC enrollment form allowed for there to be multiple producers, or you might think of them as co-signers, co-owners. So that might mean oftentimes that the first generation owns 60% of the farm, the second generation 40%. So we split their payment in that way.
Makes perfect sense. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Chair Poppy. Ms. Breeze, we've heard some talk about other types of programs that FSA is not the easiest agency to get share information with. How did you find the experience of working with them in getting this program off the ground?
Ms. Bress.
Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, truthfully, along the way, they were wonderful to work with. Everybody that we worked with in their state office was great, and we had wonderful relationships working with the with county staff as well when that was necessary.
Representative Anderson.
Thanks again, Chair Poppy. Just a little confusion on my part. If a farm signed up for round one and got their maximum of $5,000, what was round two for? Was that for an additional 50,000 pounds of production, or explain why the two payments if a farm signed up first time?
Madam Chair, Representative Ann Anderson, in each round one and round two, producers were eligible for up to 50,000 pounds. So even a very large farm, would both round one and round two were based upon 50,000 hundredweight, and those very small farms would receive payments in both round one and round two based upon their total production in 2018. We split this up between two rounds so that those producers, because we knew it was very important to the producers that they get those checks into their hands as soon as possible. And if it would have delayed the payment process considerably if we would have had to wait till we receive all of the applications and then determined a payment amount.
Representative Anderson.
Just one more again. Thanks, Madam Chair. The program went very well. The only negative feedback I heard was that some didn't want to sign up for the full 5 years of the Dairy Margin Protection Program, and I understand the reasoning why. Under the supposition that we may do this again sometime, could you see any changes you'd make in the program if this ever came up again that you would like to see implemented?
Ms. Bress.
Madam Chair, Representative, I don't think I'm probably the most qualified one to answer that question. and I say that because my expertise is in grant making and program administration. My expertise isn't in the status of our dairy farms and what they're undergoing. I'd be happy to get that feedback for you, but I don't think I'm the best qualified right now.
Representative Anderson.
That's just one. I promise, just one more. So we got 1,800 producers, 1,500 farms. What percentage of farmers did we reach with this program? Do you have that information?
Ms. Bress.
Madam Chair, Representative, I do not have that information on me. I think we would need to check in with USDA to determine what their total enrollment was in the state and go from there.
Could you?
Yes, Representative Anderson.
Could you get the information about how many dairy farmers we reached with this program?
Ms. Bress.
Madam Chair, Representative, I don't see any reason why we wouldn't be able to do that.
And thank you. Thank you for answering those questions. Next Tuesday is Minnesota Milk Dairy Day on the Capitol, and I think we'll have more information. So we might be able to provide that, you know, next week with some other people that would be able to, you know, answer those questions. So thank you. Anybody else have questions? Otherwise, thank you for the presentation and the information. Thank you for the hard work and the fast and speedy way that you took care of it, because I think it was definitely a little complicated trying to come up with what those numbers should be and how people would be able to be eligible and what the process was going to be. So very much appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you.
So we now are going to talk about another part of the industry that we're becoming more familiar with, and that's industrial hemp. And Anthony, is it Cordelette? We are welcome to the committee. And again, I think there's information in your folder for this presentation. So welcome to the committee. Just state your name, and then you can go ahead with the presentation.
Great. Madam Chair, members of the committee, thanks for having me. My name is Anthony Cordelette, and I supervise both the noxious weed and industrial hemp programs for the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. Today, I want to give you a brief update, as brief as I can, on a program that has a lot going on, and that is industrial hemp. Most of you are familiar, hold on, it's not coming up on your screen here.
Thanks. There, it just needs to move to the next slide, maybe, or something.
I'll just start. Well, if someone can help. I'll just talk while we figure this out.
All right, that sounds good.
In 2014, most of you are familiar that after a long bout of prohibition with cannabis in general in the United States, the 2014 Farm Bill paved the way for legalization to begin for hemp production. It defined hemp separately for the first time in law from marijuana, which was the primary definition for cannabis under the Controlled Substance Act. And it also allowed State Department of Agriculture's across the U.S. to develop pilot programs that could study the growth, cultivation, and marketing of hemp. And that was significant here in Minnesota because immediately thereafter, in the 2015 legislative session, the legislature passed the Minnesota Industrial Hemp Development Act, which gave the Minnesota Department of Agriculture authority to begin operating under pilot programs and to establish licensing regulations for industrial hemp. And we began right away creating our pilot program in 2015. We were one of the first states in the U.S., along with Kentucky, Colorado, I believe Tennessee, and a handful of others, that began operating hemp programs. We didn't actually get seed into the ground until the following year, but we were able to begin figuring out how we wanted to go forward and trying to solicit growers to begin hemp production in the state. I'll try to follow my notes here. Hopefully you guys have a printout.
We have the information in our folder, and there should be other copies available if people wanted to go and get one.
Okay, thank you. One of the things about the original farm bill in the provision was it did not remove hemp from the Controlled Substances Act. So that did create somewhat of a problem for us in terms of partnerships with federal law enforcement, as well as confusion amongst our local law enforcement. However, I think we did a good job of putting things in place to make sure that hemp growers were essentially growing hemp. And in 2018, the next iteration of the Farm Bill came along and was passed at the end of that year, which essentially added to the Agricultural Marketing Act of 1946 a section for industrial hemp production. And so now industrial hemp is an agricultural commodity in the U.S. It's legal to grow throughout the United States. And the United States Department of Agriculture's Agricultural Marketing Service has the primary authority for hemp regulation in the U.S. What the 2018 Farm Bill allowed, though, was for states and tribes to be able to submit plans to the USDA that would be approved for them to retain regulatory authority over hemp within their jurisdictions. So the other thing it did was it removed hemp as defined from the Controlled Substances Act, and that's significant because now hemp is defined differently than marijuana. So any cannabis that is of total THC content of 0.3% or less is considered industrial hemp. It also protects the interstate commerce and transportation of hemp. So it specifically states that tribes and state and local law enforcement cannot interfere with commerce or transport of legal industrial hemp. One of the things it doesn't do, and this still creates a lot of confusion out there, it did not change the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act, which the FDA oversees and which governs our, you know, most of our food laws. And so I'm sure most of you are well aware of cannabinoid products like cannabidiol, CBD, that are virtually everywhere now. Those are not considered to be legal additives to either food or dietary supplements by the FDA. And there has been no change other than passage of Minnesota Statute 151.72, which allowed for sale of certain cannabinoid products out of last session. It still is considered federally illegal. I think that was the last one, but let's... it's still considered illegal under FDA rule to add those cannabinoids to foods. Some states have gotten around that by passing state laws to amend what their federal law says, but that doesn't currently exist here in Minnesota. Sorry. So essentially where we're at now is in an area where more recently we've had the federal government through USDA pass interim rules for hemp production. And okay, excellent. We're up and going now. I don't have to make this up as I go along. And we're primarily talking about three different types of growth in Minnesota, and it's important, I think, for everyone to understand that when the initial Farm Bill was discussed and even the initial testimony for the Minnesota Industrial Hemp Development Act, we were talking about two forms of hemp production, fiber and grain. And I would argue even the 2018 Farm Bill language still pertains to that. And that's important to realize because that 0.3% THC number is fairly liberal when you're talking about a fiber or a grain hemp plant. In other words, most of those varieties have been around for a long time. They've been bred. They've been tested. The genetics are fairly solid. What's become more popular in recent years is production of cannabinoid extracts, and we'll call that CBD hemp farming, for lack of a better way to describe it. That's where most of our farmers are interested in growing because a year to 2 years ago, there were wild estimates of anywhere from $20,000 to $80,000 an acre could be produced. And if you're a corn and soybean grower right now that's struggling to get by, that sounds pretty good. Unfortunately, there's risk with growing those types of plants. Essentially, they come out of the fresh marijuana industry, if you want to call it that, from states like Colorado, California, where businesses were developing, but because it's not legal under federal law to produce marijuana, they could only exist within the state, like Colorado, where they were operating. The new hemp definition gave them an opportunity to move into states where hemp is legal and to begin producing non-psychoactive cannabinoids. So the plants that are generally grown for CBD or cannabinoid extraction are fairly less reliable, I would say, genetically, just because the breeding hasn't been allowed to grow as well as with fiber and grain. So the other thing about the CBD or cannabinoid production is it looks very similar to marijuana production, and we commonly get calls from folks around the state that see these more big, bushy Christmas tree style farms with hemp growing versus the more standard row crop fiber and grain type production of hemp. So it's challenging, but we're working our way through it. In Minnesota, there's requirements that you must be licensed to obtain or to be able to grow hemp. You also have to report all your fields to the department, and you have to grow under 0.3%. We have recently put into place an e-licensing system that we worked with Minnit on. That has greatly lessened our burden. Right now I have two tremendously talented full-time staff covering all the activities of hemp, and they're gratefully appreciative this year to have that type of a system in place. That allows also the growers or processors obtaining a license to go online and buy one. The other requirement that we have is that all licensees must pass a criminal history background check. That's required under both our state law as well as the federal law. And so we do that currently under our pilot program for first-time applicants. The new USDA rules, which I'll get to here in a second, they have a little different interpretation of that, and we're trying to work through what that's going to mean for the future. As I said, I have two staff, and we do go out and sample and test every single field in the state. And that gets to be challenging, especially in a year like last year where we had exponential growth in hemp. I'll show you a graph of some of that data here in a couple slides. We generally do random sampling. We collect 30 samples per field. We make a homogenized sample, bring that to our third-party accredited lab, which happens to be Legend Technical Services right here in St. Paul. We've been using Legend since we started the pilot program, primarily because our state agricultural lab is not set up to do cannabis testing. You have to understand that if they hot hemp, as we'd call it, that tests above the 0.3 comes in, the lab is now in possession of a controlled substance. And so that requires quite a bit of manipulation and build out to our lab facility. So it's always been easier to use a third-party lab. They also do all the medical cannabis testing for our two facilities in the state under the medical cannabis program. They're ISO certified. They follow cannabis procedures, as well as we have them enrolled in two different proficiency tests nationwide, where it's kind of testing the tester to make sure that they're accurate. If you go above 0.3, you fail the test, you have two options. One of them is destroy your field. The other is you can dispute the test and require or request that the department come out and collect a second sample at your cost. If you fail the second test, it's done. Unfortunately, you have to destroy the crop. I say that to you folks with a heavy heart. That's the worst part of this job. There isn't a farmer I know who purposely tried to grow a controlled substance. It goes back to that whole point I talked about, the lack of good solid genetics in that CBD arena. Our fiber and grain producers have never failed a test, but this is something we need to work out in that area of cannabinoid extraction. We had about 12% test failure. That's fairly low when you consider states like Arizona had 40%. It's still too much, and this is something that we would like to eliminate from having to do, tell a farmer that's trying to do the right thing that their crop is hot. Here's some statistics you can look at. You can see the growth of our program. We started with six pioneer farmers, and we grew to 343 last year. Those numbers obviously are relatively low if we're comparing it to small grain or corn or soybeans. But it shows an emerging market. There was a big uptick between 2018 and 2019. This is because of the passage of the federal farm bill and a lot of excitement in hemp. But it was also relative to the price for crude CBD oil on the market, going back to that $20,000 per $80,000 per acre estimate. And so you can also see that below in the different types of hemp that were grown. We started out primarily as a grain state, and then in about 2018, you start seeing more CBD come in, and by 2019, grain and CBD almost flip-flop. So that's really where a lot of the interest is in the industry right now. However, I will point out that the price of crude is about a quarter now of what it was, because every state in the U.S., 47 states, in fact, that had hemp laws had this kind of exponential growth. And so the market right now is just saturated with crude oil, and that the hemp growers are starting to learn what, you know, that type of market looks like, where the based on supply and demand anyway. So we currently have about 10 to 20 extractors in the state. That's pretty significant from where we were 2 years ago. There is, as well as the cannabinoid products and the supply by the, or the demand, I should say, by the public for those, there's also developed a hemp smokable market. So farmers will get a premium for harvesting their hemp flower and selling it. It's the same concept of taking some type of an oral product. You're simply inhaling the cannabinoids into your lungs. A lot of times these are marketed as anti-smoking opportunities too, even though it's somewhat ironic that you're still smoking. But I think it's to get rid of the tobacco nicotine habit. We don't really have fiber processing, and that is crucial. Almost all of my colleagues in other states, we all agree that for long-term sustaining hemp program, fiber production is essential. It's a no-brainer. Just do the math. There's literally thousands upon thousands of products that hemp fiber can go into. In fact, we've been in discussions with the Minnesota Department of Transportation, who are under a directive to reduce the amount of plastics and roadside restoration products like fiber meshes, vegetation meshes, and so forth. Those things don't break down. Hemp fiber is a possibility to integrate into a system like that. That's just one of, I could go on for hours, and I don't want to bore you with that, but that's really what we're hoping. The problem is hemp fiber production or processing is expensive. It takes a large investment. It's really sad that in Minnesota prior to Prohibition in the 1940s, we had processing plants in Minnesota for this, and they either had to be retrofitted to something else or they were torn down. So we're learning that we're having to restart an industry that used to exist. We do have some companies that are offering contracts to farmers for both grain and seed, couple in Canada, one in Wisconsin, and one here in Minnesota, and I expect that will also increase over time. So where we're currently at in terms of the regulatory aspect is a little bit of limbo. USDA was required when the Farm Bill passed to put forth rules for hemp production, and they did that by releasing them this Halloween. That couldn't have been a worse time for us to have those released. I think it was 161 pages for us to comb through while we had to start licensing both growers and processors for 2020. And the reason we need to do that is some farmers have crops that go over the December 21st or the 31st deadline for when our license expires. And so the rules are fairly close to how we operate our pilot program, but I would say there are some major sticking points that would be pretty damaging to the hemp industry that we've been developing over the last 5 years, and certainly our growers and processors have let us hear that. They did open up their interim rules for comment nationwide, and one good thing that happened through the 2018 Farm Bill was it also extended the provision in the 2014 Farm Bill for 1 year after the USDA posted these rules. So technically, Minnesota can operate under a pilot program until October 31st this year. And that's important because we held three listening sessions throughout the state right after these rules were posted by USDA, and they were very well attended. We had one here in St. Paul, one in Detroit Lakes, and one in Mankato. And we heard very clearly from Minnesota farmers and processors what they thought about these rules. And primarily there's things that revolve around how we sample, whether or not remediation of hot hemp is allowable, and do we have to sample every field or can we do some type of random sampling. All of these things are something that we've talked with the U.S. Domestic Hemp Program. We've been in conversation with them. We let them know that we will be operating under a pilot program this year so that we don't damage the you know, growing industry that we have. While we try to work on a state plan that we can submit, hopefully before the end of this fall and have it approved, where we can start operating under the USDA rule. I also want to mention that DEA has a lot of involvement in the rule. They're written into it. That's kind of a sticking point, and so we're working with DEA on a lot of these issues also. And it's not that it's you know, a bad thing. It's just it's sort of hard for us to plan and tell you what this looks like you know, in the upcoming months. So with that, I know I covered a big topic as quick as I could. I'll open it up to any questions.
And thank you, Mr. Cordelet. We do have a number of questions. We'll start out with Representative Miller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I say your name right. Mr. Cordelet. Okay, thank you very much for this. This was a great presentation. In the brief time you had, you did an excellent job. Two real quick questions. One on your presentation, it said hemp smokable market is growing as well. That elicits a lot of things in my mind. Can you just give like a one-minute version of what that looks like and what that means?
Mr. Cordelet.
Madam Chair, Representative Miller, essentially a lot of your smoke shops and head shops are finding a way for them to diversify their product lines with actual hemp flower. The best way I can describe that is it's exactly like smoking marijuana. It does pose some problems for law enforcement, and we work a lot with them on what is, you know, the person they just pulled over, what is it? Is it hemp? Is it legal, or is it illegal marijuana? So I don't know how far that market will grow. That's, you know, does it keep growing or has it kind of reached its peak and it was sort of a novelty that just blew up within the last year because this smokable hemp flower became available?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And that's something we'll want to keep an eye on. Now, the other question I have, and I'm trying to keep it simple and have your answer simple on this, but the hemp producers that I know that are kind of taking the route of cannabinoid oils, the marketplace is a challenge. Now, you can't necessarily do anything about that. What I mean is once they have the hemp, to get it to a processor, to get paid for it, that whole dynamic because of banking law and things like that is a challenge. Can you give kind of an outlook of how we're how that's going to be helped in the next year? Because I have people that have a lot of hemp on hand that really practically don't have any place to sell it. So what is that looking like
Mr.
right now?
Mr. Cordelet.
Madam Chair, Representative Miller, it's a great question, and it is an issue. This body will receive two different reports from two different cannabinoid groups that were assembled out of the last legislative session that will address some of that. What I will tell you is that there are currently no regulations for hemp processing of cannabinoids right now. And that poses a problem because there's no protection for the farmer. There's no protection for the processor. It works both ways. So we need to work on that. And again, those reports go into that. There's also, with increased demand, there's trying to get the infrastructure built up to support it. And I'm interested to see what happens this year now that prices are kind of either leveling out or declining a little bit. Maybe it'll give us some breathing room to establish more processing to help those farmers in what they're trying to do.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. We have a couple more questions. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And last year we passed in the environment bill a provision looking at changing from plastics and conservation materials. So the things that our departments of transportation use, whether it's a state department or local, on conservation silt fences, or whether it's netting, whether Board of Water and Soil Resources and soil water districts are using plastic because that plastic breaks down in the rivers and then we are getting the microplastics in there. So you mentioned in your presentation about using hemp has there been any further work on that? I think that our Department of Transportation is buying hemp products from like North Carolina or Florida. What is the department doing on with what you're doing, connecting with the Department of Transportation and the conservation organizations on replacing plastic conservation materials with hemp?
Mr. Cordelet.
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen. Right now, the Department of Transportation example is probably the one that sticks out the most right now that we've had action on. We've met with them several times, and we've also put them in touch with AURI, or the Ag Utilization Research Center. They're looking at a company right now in Canada that produces some fiber mats, for example. And this is just one example of several that I won't go into in detail. But I think AURI has bought a smaller decorticator, and they're going to start trying to find different fiber thicknesses and stuff that would work for MnDOT. And my colleague Ken Gravy over at MnDOT is working with them to try to figure out, okay, how can we get a way forward with this? We're hoping that if we can get some ground with that, we can start putting some hemp farmers in the cycle too, and maybe have sort of a pilot project for that, and then grow upon that.
Okay. Next person, Representative Bang.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I'm looking at the table in this slide, the numbers of applicants versus licensed growers. I just want to know what made that difference. Is there a acreage requirement, or what other requirements that is that why half the applicants didn't become licensed?
Madam Chair, Representative Vang.
I
can't specifically tell you why that is. I can tell you that a lot of folks after the Farm Bill passed wanted to buy a license and be prepared to grow. There is no, by the way, acre limitation or any of that. The only real limitation we've had to put in is growing in a residential dwelling. And we just did that recently. But as of last year, most of it came down to a lot of folks had, big ideas on this, and they couldn't find land. We do have a significant amount of urban, residents who want to get into this, but they don't have the land to farm on, and I think that may have played a significant role in this. And so they're trying to find ways to network with farmers and maybe scrape out a few acres to be able to, go out into rural areas and grow this.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Bang.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And then on a separate note, I do think so that we got to, support some way to bring back the market is going through the fiber process. And so what do you think the state should do or should look at to spur that activity more?
Mr. Cordelat.
Madam Chair, Representative Vang. I think, you know, it would be nice if there would be some way to help investors get drawn into the state and be comfortable with investing their money here. There are folks that have contacted us from, you know, New York and California that want to come here and try to do business. I don't deal with those kinds of transactions, and I don't know what is preventing them from throwing their money down here and choosing Minnesota as a place to build a fiber processing facility. But if there were a way that we could somehow draw them in and get them to invest money, we certainly have the growers, and if they come and invest the money, we'll get more growers to grow the fiber.
Thank you. This has generated a lot of discussion, and unfortunately we're going to have to move on, because I know that we will probably in the next 2 weeks, I think, we'll have some hemp-related bills on that we're going to try and process through. So hopefully, if you don't mind holding any more questions till we have those bills coming through, I appreciate it. Because we have some people from out of town, we want to make sure that we get to them today. So I do appreciate, Mr. Cordelat, that you've come and you've generated discussion and given us lots of good information. And we will, perhaps you'll be able to come back then at that time, because we'll devote a little bit more time to it. So thank you for coming today, and thank you, members of the committee, for accommodating that. I just want to be able to, we want to make sure that we get to the Center for Rural Policy and Development, and then we have some other people that are here that are going to be talking about the emerging farmers. So appreciate that, and we will next go to the center. And so we have the president, CEO, Julie Tesh is the first person that will introduce her cohorts there and be able to provide some information. They've done some recent reporting, yeah. And so welcome to the committee, Ms. Tesh, if you can go ahead and introduce yourself.
Yes, good morning, Madam Chair, members. For the record, my name is Julie Tesh, and I am the president and CEO of the Center for Rural Policy and Development. Very happy to be here today. Thank you, Chair Poppy, for inviting us in on the first day of committee. We're very happy to be here. I would like to introduce, we have in the audience, we have Marnie Werner, our VP of Operations and Research, and then we also have Kelly Ash, who is a research associate, and I'll turn it over to him in a couple minutes. I would also be remiss if I didn't mention that we do have a couple board members in the audience today. We have Tim Veldy representing Minnesota Farmers Union. We have a brand new board member, Dr. Matt Loiza, from Minnesota State University, Mankato, and then also Representative Lippert here on the committee as well as a board member. So we're going to be referring you to this handout that you're just getting. You're in for a wild ride, because we're a research organization and we have data. And so we have two wonderful researchers, and they do yeoman's work, and you'll find that out. And so we do a thought leader survey every year, and this was the number one question that came out of our thought leader survey this last year is, you know, what is the effect of the down ag economy on rural Minnesota? So this is the number one thing that thought leaders like yourself came back with. And so I'm going to turn it over to Kelly Ash, and we're going to get started.
Welcome to the committee, and just introduce yourself and then be able to go ahead.
Sure. Thanks, Chair Poppy, members of the committee. My name is Kelly Ash, Center for Rural Policy and Development. All three of us live and work out of rural Minnesota. I live in New London, Minnesota, in Candiahuy County. Julie works out of, well, I say Waldorf, but Waseca probably is more where more people would know where she lives. And then Marnie's out of Mankato. And so when we're talking about the topic of the downturn in the rural, in agriculture and its impact on the rural economy, this kind of strikes home with us because we're kind of seeing some of these impacts and some of the impacts that aren't happening. And there's a lot of conversations around this. So the research question, and I apologize, I am not sure. Let me check the display settings here real quick, see if I can get, no. Well, I don't know why it's getting cut off, but our research question was, what are the implications of the downturn in the agriculture economy on rural communities and their economy? Let me go through some of the goals we had with this. So the first part was examine the data and dispel some myths. I'm sure some of you have been hearing a lot about farmers not doing well, the agriculture economy not doing well, thus the rural economy must be doing bad. I think the most recent example is Beth Ford, CEO of Land O'Lakes, had a letter to the editor, op-ed, in the Star Tribune talking about how bad agriculture is doing right now and the impacts that it's having on our rural communities and really making that direct link. But none of this has ever backed up with any sort of data, and so we wanted to try and see if we can sort through the data and kind of see what these impacts are and specifically get at the location. And that was kind of our second goal. So how does the agriculture economy affect Minnesota's overall rural economy? And I think more importantly, where? Exactly where? We all have our definitions of what rural is, but there actually isn't a good definition of rural. And so we are hoping to kind of get specific and figure out where are the areas where we're seeing the most impacts. And then the third part is what policy might be needed and would be helpful for Minnesota's farmers in relation to the rural economy. And this part we're actually not going to be talking about today because we are actually in the midst of this research. So this is all just kind of first go. This is what we're seeing in the data because we just started this project a few months ago. So I apologize. That's probably what you're most interested in, but we won't be able to talk about it much today. What we looked at, so we looked at three things, and it's important to know when we talk about agriculture, it's broad, right? And particularly when we're looking at data, there's a couple different things we're looking at. One is the farm economy. So this is farmers and the people working and producing livestock and selling livestock and producing crops and selling the crops and things like that on the farm. So this is sole proprietors, this is folks working on the farm and things like that. Then there's the ag-related industries economies, food manufacturing, merchant wholesalers, things like that. Those are kind of wage employees. That's a whole separate economy that we have to analyze in the data. And then we compare this to the overall rural economy. Again, the rural economy does not equal agriculture. It's pretty diversified, and so we make some comparisons across the board. We do that by comparing revenues and earnings on the farms along with the wages of the people working and employment. So that's what we're going to be looking at today and comparing that with what changes are happening in the rural employment and wages and what's happening in these industries involved in agriculture and compare the two to see what's happening. So let's get started. So in order to do this research, we actually kind of have to figure out where farmers are at because we can't figure out what the impacts are going to be if we don't know how farmers are doing today and how those impacts trickle down then into the economy. So let's just look at farms real quick. So we have the farm economy peaks and valleys. That's too bad it's cut off. So this is farm cash receipts from marketing and production expenses. The blue line is farm cash receipts. That's just general revenue from selling crops, livestock production, things like that, and then the expenses associated with that. And you'll see, well, you can't see, but during the crop commodity boom, we saw this huge gap where revenues were really good, expenses were increasing, but there's a nice gap there, making some nice, healthy net income, and now they've merged. So over the past few years, there's little net income being made. Expenses and revenues are pretty much the same. Actually, farm revenues from production has dropped 20% since kind of the crop commodity boom. So we want to look at solvency and liquidity on our farms, and this is the debt-to-asset ratio per farm in Minnesota. And so the debt-to-asset looks at all the debt, compares it to all the assets, and what's the percentage of that? And you can't see it, but by 2018, the Minnesota average debt-to-asset ratio is about 13%. So the amount of debt that farmers had was 13% of what their assets were. We actually took a look at during what we consider the farm crisis, because everybody keeps saying, like, are we approaching, you know, the 1980s farm crisis again? And that red line on top was the U.S. average for farms debt-to-asset ratio in the United States, and that was 19%. Again, we're at about 13% right now, so we're not real close. But there's a good argument to be made that debt-to-asset isn't always a great measurement because a lot of folks are currently worried about liquidity, and that's where we're seeing a pretty big drop-off. So this is the current ratio. So this is looking at assets, either cash or assets that can be converted to cash rather quickly, looking and then what debt obligations need to be met in the next 12 months. That's the current ratio. Mm-hmm. And right now, you can't see it on here, but there's this humongous drop going down to 2018 where we're at about 1.7. What that means is for every dollar, $1.70 in assets that a farmer has, there's $1 of liabilities. So we're getting pretty close. And bankers, this is what they look at when they're putting out loans this spring, is looking at this current ratio. And they like to see if it gets close to 1.25, they get pretty nervous and they're not going to start lending. And we're getting closer to that. What this means is farmers are using up a lot of their assets to meet their current obligations and are burning through some of their easily liquidated assets to meet their debt obligations. So that's what that's what's happening on farms. So how does that translate into communities in rural areas? So the farm economy impact locations, we're looking at earnings. And so earnings is farmers' sole proprietorship. Yeah, take a seat. If you can fix that, that'd be great.
And this is available on the website, so unfortunately.
Not yet, because we're in the middle of this research, but we could send you the presentation.
But on our website, I think your presentation is on our website, so unfortunately we don't have our computers with us, most of us today, so we can't see it. So hopefully it gets, we can repair it. But
So looking at farm earnings then. So farm earnings is essentially the net income. So the income farmers are making after production along with some of the wages and compensation by hard laborers. And what you can see is on the left side is an index. And we in your handout, you'll see we have like the rural urban commuting areas. So we have the county group that's entirely rural, a county group that has a town-rural mix, a county group that's urban, town-rural, and then a county group that's entirely urban. And you can kind of see how those categorizations work. And you can see there are actually counties outside of the seven-county metro that are entirely urban, Blue Earth County being one of them. And those, we like to use this designation because it gives a little bit more nuance because there actually aren't a lot of counties that are entirely urban or entirely rural. Most counties are somewhere in between. And so these five lines represent Minnesota and then those four RUCA categories. And yeah, you can see it a little bit there now. Perfect.
Is that good?
Yep, thank you. Appreciate that. And you can see that red circle on the left side is growth in farm earnings indexed to the 2001 levels. And you'll see during the crop commodity boom that huge increase, right? Every single RUCA category had about 600 to 400% larger net income or farm earnings compared to they did in 2001. And then you see afterwards that huge drop off where now farm earnings are at pretty much where they were in 2001. So we want to compare what those are in terms of total earnings. If farm earnings make up a large percentage of total earnings for these areas, then we should see a similar spike. On this particular chart, we'll see that only entirely rural areas, the entirely rural county group is the only one with the spike. All the other types of counties have a diversified enough economy where farm earnings don't make up a significant percentage of the total earnings in those counties, and thus they're a little bit more straight. You don't see that spike. So again, we're kind of looking at entirely rural areas as being the ones most impacted by earnings. We can look at employment. So this is farm employment, so not ag industry employment. This is employment such as sole proprietors and folks working on the farm, hired laborers. And you can see there's been a decrease in farm employment since 2001. It's been dropping off pretty steadily. There wasn't a huge increase during the crop commodity boom either. This is due to a number of factors, farms getting bigger, more automation, things like that. We compare the total employment index to 2001 for all of the areas. So the total employment on the right side of the chart there, and you'll see that they've been increasing in our entirely rural areas has been seeing decreases since 2001. There isn't a lot of evidence that farm employment makes up a big percentage of employment in our rural areas. However, this is pretty big groups, and so we dug in a little bit deeper to kind of see, okay, more specifically at some of our EDRs and at the county level, are we seeing some of those impacts? And that's where you do. This is three counties that we pointed out in that handout, that or three EDRs that we pointed out in our handout that kind of highlight where we think there are some issues related to earnings, where the farm earnings make up a significant portion of the total earnings in those counties. And those EDRs that we look at are four, which is West Central, 6W, which is the Upper Minnesota River Valley, so like Swift County, Lac Parle, Yellow Medicine, and then 8, which is Southwest. These aren't big shockers, right? We knew Southwest Minnesota would probably feel this worse than anywhere else. Northwest wasn't as impacted as we thought it would be. We were kind of surprised by that. We thought there would be more significant declines. And again, you can see we actually compared these EDRs with EDR 9, a typical EDR where you'd think agriculture plays a pretty big role. And a lot of counties weren't showing a lot of impacts in EDR 9. You can see it here again, looking at farm earnings, you're seeing that spike on the left side, but on the right side, it's only those three EDRs that I pointed out that show a similar spike and decline, while EDR 9 kind of just continued its trajectory. Again, EDR 9 has Mankato in it, and so if any place has a larger urban area, there's enough diversification that you're not going to see the impacts as much. So, okay, That's talking about farm earnings. Now there's the whole ag industry side of things. And so we worked with the University of Minnesota, Department of Applied Economics, to try and come up with the categories in which farmers are likely going to have to spend less in order to compensate for the reduction in farm earnings. And so these are the four categories that we've been looking at: farm machinery purchases, building purchases, indoor improvements, cropland rental payments, and fertilizer purchases. Are kind of the four most givable as far as being able to reduce the spending. So we looked at the gross sales for these ag-related industries and compared it to total gross sales. And we can see that the green line there with ag-related businesses, you're seeing that kind of spike and then that decline of gross sales since 2003. And then all businesses, you'll see, saw the Great Recession hit, had a little reduction, but then just kind of kept on plucking along. So there are some impacts in ag-related industries. But when we look at the ag-related industries as a percentage of total employment across our planning regions, so this each color represents a planning region, you'll notice Southwest Minnesota has the highest with right around 11%. There's a couple things to take from this chart. One is Southwest obviously has a high percentage. But the second thing is there's no trends. There's no bump when crop commodity boom hit. There's no decline when the crop commodity prices have gone down. They've stayed relatively flat. Which is kind of interesting. And we'll kind of talk a little bit about why that might be here in a few slides. So we took a look at wages to see, okay, maybe folks are, you know, taking pay cuts or what might be happening in wages. And again, we're not seeing anything big. There's a couple interesting elements on this chart. One is just seeing just kind of a gradual increase in wages, nothing too big. The second piece, that blue line, is actually the 7-county metro area. So for a lot of metropolitan areas, counties in the room, that may think agriculture doesn't touch you, some of the highest paid jobs are actually in the 7-county metro when it comes to ag-related industries, particularly around merchant wholesalers, which is kind of interesting. And you can see the average ag-related industry employment per or wage per employment was right around $72,000 in the 7-county metro by 2018. The next closest was Southwest at $52,000. Pretty significant difference. It's kind of an interesting fact there. And again, this is looking at the 2018 ag-related industry wages per employment map-wide. And you can kind of see where the concentration of wages per employment is located in the, particularly Hennepin and Ramsey County, and then down in Blue Earth and below. And then in the southwest section, you'll see more wages. That's just kind of an interesting tidbit. I think I'll leave it at that. I'll move ahead here. So why aren't we seeing bigger impacts? And there's a couple things. One that needs to be mentioned is farmers are shouldering the downturn and taking on more debt. They have to continue to produce, they have to take on more debt, and they have to continue buying the seed, continue buying the fertilizer, and doing their thing. And so essentially, any ripple effects that are happening because of prices, they're taking on that burden, and it's not trickling down yet. How much longer that can go, I don't know. Also, farmers tend to invest when times are good, and so when the crop commodity boom kind of happened there and they had were flush with revenue, that's likely when a lot of the purchases happened. And since then, they have been able to kind of stave off and do their thing without having to make any sort of major purchases or anything like that. And also, it needs to be mentioned, the rural economy is more diverse than people think. There isn't as direct of a link from agriculture to the rural economy as people want there to be. It's not that it isn't important. It is important. But when we're looking at rural community and economic development, there's a lot of other things that need to be taken into account when we're talking about those pieces. So further research we're going to be looking at, and we'd be happy to answer questions and also take some input at what you guys would like to see, because we're here for you. We're going to be looking at more nuanced impacts in our most rural counties, EDRs 4, 6W, and R, and 8. We didn't include retail sales in our analysis, and it would be interesting to see with less net income and less earnings from farms, are they spending less just on retail in general? How does that mean on a household side, or where are they cutting corners? The second piece is, how much longer can farmers hold on? We're hearing rumors and murmurings that it's likely we're going to see more bankruptcies this spring, that loans from banks might get a little bit tighter, a little bit harder to come by. And so it's going to be interesting to see what the general impacts from that are. And then, how might a drop in agricultural land values impact property tax-dependent programs? Land values are staying stubbornly high. I didn't put a chart in here, but we have the chart that shows land values go almost one-to-one with the increases in the crop commodity boom. They both increased. And now as crop commodities have declined, the land values have stayed relatively stable, maybe a little bit of decline, but not nearly as much. As bankruptcies happen and as bigger farmers come in and buy up the land or institutions come up and buy the land, there's a little bit of a nervousness about what kind of leverage these people will have in purchasing this land and drop prices and land values down, which might have some pretty significant ramifications on school referendums and other type property tax referendums for our rural areas. As most of you probably know, when schools are passing a referendum, agricultural land property taxes makes up a significant portion of referendums and bonding. And so that's going to be something that we're going to be keeping an eye on, too. So just to end, too, just talking about the rural economy, we did a whole research project last year talking about workforce shortages in rural areas. Everywhere outside of seven-county metro is either at the same level or if not feeling more pressure to fill job vacancies than they are in the seven-county metro area. This is a significant issue. And when you talk to any of our rural community and economic developers, this is the number one issue they're talking about is people recruitment and retention. And so I think, you know, looking at the narrative of rural areas not doing well, farm economy is bad, thus, it's actually a little bit of a disservice for our rural areas where we're seeing a ton of opportunities as far as jobs and livability than ever before. So and the largest barriers that we're seeing in rural areas is the lack of housing and childcare for people recruitment and retention. So, Madam Chair, members of the committee, we'd be happy to take questions and happy to take requests for any sort of data or slides that helps pinpoint this a little bit more. And I apologize again about the wide presentation.
That's okay. Thank you. That, you know, Ms. Tesh, you're right. Absolutely. There's a lot of information, and it was, I'm glad you rolled through it as quickly as you did. Unfortunately, you know, we don't have all day to be able to get the seminar that you deserve to have. So I appreciate that you were able to do that. You know, I'm wondering when you're going to be completing this kind of process and when do you anticipate?
Mm-hmm. Chair Poppy, thanks. We plan on this next month. So hopefully in the next few weeks, we're in the process of running this data by a few more experts just to make sure we're talking about things right. And we want to get some more evidence on the ground. We like to do the data thing, but we want to try and find, you know, go to Swift County and some of these other counties and get a little bit more kind of on the ground. How is it feeling? How is it shaking out? Things like that, because anecdotes are helpful when it comes to the data and putting groundiness.
Thank you.
A little bit
more. I think when you get to that point, maybe we'll have a kind of a set time that we could have you do a presentation, maybe not even within the committee, but, you know, set aside a room where you'd be able to give us some information. Maybe I think that would be helpful because and have handouts. Yes, that would be helpful.
Yeah.
Too. Okay. So we've got four people on the list. I'm going to roll right through them. Representative Anderson.
Just very quickly. Thanks, Madam Chair. A quick question on your statistics about comparing metro area ag-related jobs to the greater Minnesota area. Did your metro area jobs include, for example, the CEOs of CHS, Land O'Lakes, Cargill, to really skew that number?
Mr. Ash.
Yeah, Chair Poppy, Representative Anderson. Yeah, I think so. Absolutely, it does. Yep, that's going to skew it. Also, these are the types of jobs where it might be graphic design, marketing, communications, things that are more kind of 9-to-5, I don't want to say college-level type jobs, but more of that kind of administrative type management positions. That's probably where they're held.
Yeah. Good point. Representative Cleburne.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And my question is related to that issue. I represent Plymouth, Minnesota.
Yeah.
So I asked specifically to be on this committee because we have a lot of food and ag-related employment, and they are good-paying jobs. Mm-hmm. And the face of agricultural jobs is changing. So when we are thinking about agriculture going forward, and we're looking at positions that can be done outside of the rural living area, but are still very much impacting that economy. I'm wondering, when you look at the total percentage of ag-related employment versus our state employment as a whole, what do you know that percentage that truly is? I mean, I saw the data. I used my phone to read your slides. Very helpful. Do you have the data as to the comparison for total ag and food related employment versus the state employment numbers?
Yeah. Yes, Chair Poppy, Representative. Yes, I do have that data. I don't have the exact number off the top of my head, off the top of my head, but usually when we compare, so the if you're talking just ag industry, so not farm employment, not farmers, you're typically looking at statewide.
I'm actually talking about ag and food. So.
Yep. Yeah, so ag, okay. Yeah, so ag, like food manufacturing. And things. Yes. Mm-hmm. We're typically, I'd have to look back, but I want to say it's 3 to 6%. It's not huge.
Of the total state employment.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yep.
Thank you, Chair Poppe.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think you touched on the key catch-22 that's the overall challenge in agriculture, and that's the issue of land availability. Mm-hmm. And that because land values stay high, then emerging farmers can't get land. Mm-hmm. And did you look at the impacts of the MFIP payments in terms of keeping land values artificially high, and even our tax policies where we're trying to help farmers, but actually because we may keep the land values high, we prevent emerging farmers. And I don't mean passing it on to the children. Yeah. I mean new farmers coming in who've never farmed before and they can't get land because the land values are not going down. And I understand about having equity and people have their investments in their land, but until land values come down, we are not going to have land available. And there is land hoarding going on out there. There's people who have land and they can get the loans to buy more land. And so then they block out people at the auctions who may have the opportunity to get in there new. What is the solution to that land hoarding, land value stabilization that's going on?
Mr. Ash, I'm not sure you can answer that in 30 seconds, but you can give an answer. And I know, you know, when we get to the next part of our meeting, we are going to be talking about emerging farmers and what are some of the things going on with that. So we'll hit on that a little bit, but go ahead.
Yeah, Chair Poppe, Representative Hansen, thanks for the question. So I wrote it down. I haven't looked into that. All I know is just anecdotally what people are kind of predicting of things to happen. And, you know, we're at a time where the most efficient and cost-effective farmers are the ones that are going to be able to buy up the land of anyone that might be bankrupt. And right now, that's where the market is at. And so I don't know what that kind of impact that's going to have on land values. And I wrote down the program, and let's look into it, because that's our next phase on this research project, is looking at land stuff. So. Thank I can't you. Answer that. I'm sorry.
Thank you. Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Representative Hansen, for the question. I had a similar one. Land values. You said historically they tracked with grain prices or commodity prices, and currently they're not. Why is that?
Mr. Ash.
Chair Poppe, Representative Hamilton, I don't have a good answer for that. I don't know yet. And I would like to correct that. Historically, just since 2001, they tracked along with that crop commodity boom. They tracked really, really nicely. And then they haven't since, so I don't know. It's a great question.
Thank you.
Good. It sounds like we'll be able to do this again maybe in a couple of months before the end of session. We'll be able to hear more. And certainly if people have questions or have ideas, can reach out to you. Ms. Tesh, some closing comments.
Chair Poppe and committee, thank you very much. I just want to mention that you're going to be seeing a lot of things coming out from the center here this session. So we have this research project going on. We will also be releasing a project on rural health care and hospital mergers here coming up in the coming months as well. And if you want to find us, we're on social media. We're starting a podcast next week. We're having videos. Brand new website, the whole nine yards, and you will all be getting our online newsletter as well. So make sure to read that. So we're here to serve you and to give you that information about rural Minnesota. So thank you very much.
Thank you so much. Thank you. Appreciate it. And stay safe driving home. Mm-hmm. Okay. So we're turning over now to the Emerging Farmers Report. We've got Assistant Commissioner Patrice Bailey. Mr. Bailey, this is his first time before our committee, I believe, in his role, and we welcome him. We're happy to have, and I know I attended one of the Emerging Farmers sessions. Maybe others did as well, but you know, it was good information to share and to gather together. We also have Ariel Kagan is going to provide some information, and then we've got some people who have traveled a distance. So we're going to try to get everybody in. technically, we only have about 16 more minutes of a committee, but if we may have to go over, just so you know, we may be finding ourselves over that 11:15 mark. So appreciate it, and go ahead, Mr. Bailey. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you so much, Chair Poppy and committee. My name is Patrice Bailey. I'm the Assistant Commissioner at the Department of Agriculture. This is my seventh month officially. And out of the six divisions, I have three that I'm responsible for: ag marketing and development, food and feed safety, which also includes pet food, and dairy and meat inspection. So two regulatory and one division that pretty much has everything in it. Just a little bit about myself. I'm not from Minnesota originally. I grew up in Harlem, five blocks from the Apollo Theater. Went to college in Prairie View A&M in Texas, a historically black college and university, and then my master's in agriculture education at Iowa State. So I have been here since 2005, so I'm well immersed in the cold weather now. And I'm just really happy to be here. This is a great opportunity to actually be here before you. But before I go into that, I just want to let you know that Ariel and I would definitely sort of give you the breadth and the scope of the report. And then we have three testifiers that we're going to actually have sort of be the real folks that we're actually going to be talking about come talk to you about this report. So as I started this position, Commissioner Peterson wanted me to put together an emerging farmer task force. But before that, I had to put together a working group. In that working group, we decided to have one session, a listening session at MDA in September. And we invited as many ag groups, including HAFA. We had groups that were urban and master gardeners, as well as different farmers from around the state that came to this particular listening session. This listening session allowed us to be able to sort of gather some of the issues and barriers that were happening in real time around the state. And then consequently, we were going to go ahead and do five listening sessions. We started those five listening sessions in November. We started in November, and we started in Crookston, and we hoped for great weather, and we got great weather. And the great thing about this is that I wanted to be able to see those that are most affected in real time on the ground to find out what the barriers were for myself, but also to actually hear from emerging farmers themselves. And when we talk about the term emerging farmers, we're talking about new farmers from anywhere from no experience to about 10 years experience. And we're also talking about the groups that we sort of looked at five groups to comprise and highlight in this report: women, veterans, persons with disabilities, LGBTQ, veterans, communities of color, and Native Indigenous. Those were the groups that are not prominently on the agricultural landscape as we speak. In Minnesota, we have about 68,000 farms, and out of those farms, if I put those groups that I just named collectively together, it doesn't add up to about 1,000 constituents or farmers, according to the 2017 agriculture census. One of the things that I wanted to highlight was the process that we went into. These listening sessions sort of grown organically themselves. It wasn't just hearing about the barriers. We also talked about suicide. We talked about rural and mental health care, which are all barriers that are preventing people from becoming agricultural entrepreneurs. As we know, as the baby boomers are retiring and we have millennial children who do not want to sort of take on the farm, we have a lot of new people that are looking for a way to get in. And land is the biggest barrier amongst many others, but land for sure. Out of 25 million acres in Minnesota, I mean, there has to be land that we can have set aside for our agricultural entrepreneurs. So out of the all six listening sessions, we had about 144 people that participated. And wanted to thank, of course, those who was able to come to our listening sessions, including Chair Poppy as well. And we really wanted to find out what are the issues and how can we be able to assist. Now I'm going to introduce Ariel, and Ariel is going to talk about the scope and the themes and recommendations that came up.
Welcome to the committee, and just state your name and then go ahead.
Great, thank you. My name is Ariel Kagan, and I work in the Ag Marketing and Development Division at MDA. So what I think we're talking about here really is that agriculture is a cornerstone of Minnesota, and this is about how do we open the opportunity of the ag economy and the culture and social value that that has to all Minnesotans. So the report, which I believe you all have a copy of, does go into the specific categories that this committee instructed us to look into further. But we also broadened it because as we had these listening sessions, we asked people who showed up, what do you believe an emerging farmer is? And the definition of that really expanded to include other identity characteristics. Certain practices were brought up as something that people see in emerging farmers, and a value system. What was really important and what we heard was that people who identify as emerging farmers feel unseen or unrepresented in our current agricultural system, both in the markets that are available to them, the policy, and the resources that are out there to support them. So some of the themes, nothing groundbreaking here, we know that these are issues for all farmers, is land availability and prices, financial barriers, market access and infrastructure, education and training resources, and we heard from a lot of farmers that mentorships were something that was really lacking as they looked to get into farming. We also heard about discrimination and racism and sexism that people are experiencing that is something that they confront as they try to enter this field. There were a number of other themes as well that are all detailed in the report. And I think when we are talking about emerging farmers, we have to think about capital resources. So that obviously is financial capital. These are low asset individuals, typically, not always, but sometimes. And a lot of farm programs assume capital assets to begin farming, whether that's inherited land or the ability to get loans, things like that. But there are other aspects of capital as well, so human, social, and natural capital that emerging farmers have, and strengthening those resources is another way to support them in their growth in the field. So we heard from a number of folks. We had 140 show up in person, and then we also had an online survey that was open. This is a collection of just quotes that we heard that are included in the report, and I'm thrilled that we have three folks here that can actually be that voice. What we heard was wide-ranging, everything from that land access issue to rural health care and child care services, the infrastructure to support local processing, which we just heard about with hemp, and other things about relationships and mentorships, climate change, and policy. So I think before we turn it over, I did just want to talk about, in the report, there are some recommendations. establishing an emerging farmer task force that can provide expert insight and guidance to the department about how we can better support emerging farmers. And I think what really the takeaway is that there is no one solution to this. There need to be holistic and intersectional approaches to understanding how to support emerging farmers and to create a vision for how our agricultural economy can be inclusive of all folks who want to get involved in farming, which I think is something that most of us share. So I'm happy to pass it off to our next test buyers.
Yes, Chief.
Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question is on the background slide. Mm-hmm. When you talk about race, percentage of Minnesota population, and percentage of Minnesota farmers, is that only taken in consideration farm ownership, or does that also include farm employees?
Go ahead. Whoever's going to answer that, sure.
Sure. Madam Chair and Representative, that is principal operators from the National Ag Census of 2017.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Thank you. So, Mr. Bailey.
Chair Poppy, I would like to introduce our emerging farmers. I would like to start off with Hannah Bernhardt from Medicine Creek Farm in Finneson, Minnesota.
Thank you. And you know what? I'll have all three of you just come up, and then you can sit. And just, again, apologies. You know, we do our best to try to get the right time management for a committee meeting, and we want good participation from the committee as well. So this time we're running over, and my apologies to the committee members. I think if you're able to stay, we want to be able to do that and hear from all of the people that are here and have traveled the distance. So Hannah, we'll begin with you. If you just state your name, and then you can begin.
Thank you, Chair Poppy, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Hannah Bernhardt, and I'm the owner and principal operator of Medicine Creek Farm in Finlayson, Minnesota. Since 2016, I have been raising grass-fed beef and lamb and pastured pork. My husband works an off-farm job, and we have a three-year-old who most days farms alongside me. I'm one of the growing number of new regenerative farmers in Minnesota. I use management-intensive rotational grazing practices, moving my cows and sheep daily to fresh grass to optimize soil health and regenerate our land, which had been conventionally cropped and hayed before we took ownership. We have no barn for our livestock, pasturing all animals 365 days a year, and we keep 5 livestock guardian dogs to deter predators. We believe we can farm alongside a thriving natural ecosystem, including wolves and coyotes, and our pastures are full of ground nesting birds like bobolinks and meadowlarks that are quickly losing habitat elsewhere. I direct market our meat for a premium price to customers, primarily in the Twin Cities and Duluth, through our website and social media, and I'm fortunate to be 20 minutes from one of very few USDA processors in Minnesota, Lake Haven Meats in Sturgeon Lake. My customers buy from us because they care about animal welfare and humane treatment of livestock, the health of the food they eat and transparency of our practices, and our care for the environment, wildlife, and watershed. I joined Assistant Commissioner Bailey and for his Emerging Farmer Listening Session in Duluth because I believe that helping beginning farmers get on the land will make our food system more resilient for everyone. I grew up on a corn and soybean farm in southern Minnesota in the 80s and did not exactly get the message that farming was a highly desirable way to try to make a living. As I learned more about direct market local food systems, I began to see a glimmer of hope that there could be a way for farmers to get out from under the hold of large agribusiness corporations and volatile commodity markets. The growing success of organic and sustainable farmers spoke to my worry over the state of our eroding farmland, the health effects of widespread herbicide use on rural communities, and the increasingly green, unswimmable lakes of my hometown. When I began learning more about soil health and the incredible research that properly managed, rotationally grazed livestock can actually sequester carbon and fight climate change, I was convinced to make my way back to agriculture. But despite my farming background, I've still encountered numerous obstacles to establishing my farm business, and I'd like to make a few recommendations based on the report and work of the Minnesota Farmers Union that I believe could make a real difference for emerging farmers. First, I believe increasing the beginning farmer tax from 5 to 10% would strengthen the program and its ability to help young farmers access land. Despite my family owning farmland, I was unable to purchase it because my plan to direct market meat couldn't cash flow on expensive land priced for commodity crops. When my husband and I found affordable land in northeast Minnesota, our credit union told us we qualified for a loan to build a house there, but because we were planning to actually farm the land, it was too risky. Instead, we spent nearly 6 months befriending the landowner until he agreed to a contract for deed. Had the beginning farmer tax credit been in place at that time, we're certain it would have been a major incentive for deciding to sell to us and would have been a huge help to our own budget. Second, adding an advance payment option for grant funding to emerging farmers would help those without inherited land or equipment get their farm businesses started. As it stands, many of the grant opportunities the state offers work on a reimbursement model, requiring farmers to front the cost of the project, thus limiting access to those who already have a significant amount of money in the bank or the ability to secure additional loans. We encountered this problem when we received an EQIP grant for fencing before they implemented their advance payment option. I had already maxed out the amount I could borrow under the Farm Service Agency's microloan program to get the equipment and livestock to start my operation. I furthermore don't qualify for FSA's regular loan program because of the unconventional arrangement under contract for deed that allowed us to purchase our land. Ultimately, I financed the fence with credit cards and a family loan. Similarly, many emerging farmers would benefit from the creation of specific grant opportunities with higher cost-sharing percentages to establish new farm businesses. For example, I've been raising cattle and sheep for 4 years now with a makeshift working system cobbled together with T-posts, bent cattle panel, and a rusty 30-year-old head gate that sometimes works. To properly treat sick animals and sort and load livestock safely and efficiently, I would like to build a low-stress livestock handling system. The MDA's Agri-Livestock Investment Grant sounds like the perfect fit for my project, but as the grant would only cover 10% of my project cost, I would be spending a lot of time in an application for a few hundred dollars, and I'd still be left to find several thousand dollars for the project. It's easy to see how these grants might primarily go to large, established farm businesses who have access to the capital to build enormous facilities, and this is an example of how programs are often aimed at conventional farms and reward those with generational wealth and infrastructure. Before I close, I just want to emphasize that I am white, college-educated, from a farming background, and have the ability to navigate institutional resources and access family support. What has been difficult for me is monumentally more so for Black, Indigenous, Latinx, immigrant, disabled, and LGBTQ farmers. My generation needs all hands on deck to fix a broken farm economy and food system while simultaneously adapting to and fighting climate change. I urge you to do the uncomfortable work to address institutional racism, implicit bias, and equity as outlined in the report. Thank you again for the opportunity to testify today, and thank you to Commissioner Bailey, Ariel Kagan, and the rest of the members of the Department of Agriculture for holding the emerging farming listening sessions and listening to us directly.
Thank you, Ms. Bernhardt. And I'm Rachel Sanrod. Welcome.
Thank you, Chair Poppy and the committee. My name is Rachel Sanrood. I farm flowers in Mille Lacs, Minnesota. I farm about an acre of flowers on our 40-acre homestead. We've spent a lot of time rebuilding the homestead as no one has lived there since the 50s. As a beginning farmer, this is a pretty familiar experience. We don't have assets. We are not coming from farming families, and this creates challenges for us. I'm the president of the Central Minnesota Young Farmers Coalition. I'm also Minnesota Farmers Union Mille Lacs County President. I attended the Emerging Farmer Listening Session in St. Cloud, put on by Assistant Commissioner Bailey and the Department of Ag. These conversations are essential to meeting needs of the next generation of farmers to keep our rural communities strong. I know we don't have a lot of time today, so I'll be quick. I'd like to quickly highlight two recommendations from the report. First, the increase in the Authority microloan program from $10,000 to $20,000 loan limit. I used a Farm Service Agency microloan for my first tractor. And that's a very similar program to what the Rural Finance Authority offers. Beginning farmers need these programs in order to make necessary investments in their farms. Investments in their farms are investments in our communities. Each loan for a tractor, a hoop house, fencing, improves farm profitability. Farm profitability means more successful farms. More successful farms means more families in our communities. Second, I'd like to speak to the Emerging Farmer Task Force that was recommended that would meet with the commissioner. The listening sessions started many important conversations, and we shouldn't stop now. These conversations are about the future of farming in Minnesota and the unique opportunities and barriers that the next generation of farmers like myself face. This task force will create space for these critical conversations to continue, and I'd like to see that happen. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Enrod. And next we have Reginaldo Haslett-Mariquin.
Thank you. Thank you to the committee, too, for this opportunity. First of all, I'm from Guatemala. I'm a first-generation immigrant. I live in Northfield, Minnesota, and I speak for the chickens. I focused on chickens because I did study all of these challenges. I did study the conventional system. I did get a degree in agriculture in Guatemala, and I studied business management at Agbert College. So I had a lot of that same preparation, even though I'm a minority, I'm a Latino, and I'm from a foreign country. I did learn everything before venturing into agriculture, and I'm telling you, it is a very difficult thing. I think we think of emerging, but really we are just cocooning right now. We are not going to emerge yet into butterflies. This is a very uphill challenge. First of all, the issues of discrimination. I had a 70-acre farm in Belle Plaine, Minnesota, which I lost to hate and bigotry from the neighbors. I lost all of my equity that I had built over 10 years in Minneapolis while I lived here. After losing that equity, I moved to Northfield, Minnesota, where I encountered a very welcoming community and a really nurturing business network, and it gave me hope again that I could restart my ambitions of becoming a farmer. So I ended up acquiring a 1.9-acre little plot north of town. And out of there, I prototype one of the systems that we had developed across Latin America, and especially in Guatemala. Just to give you an idea, the industrial poultry system in Guatemala owns 25 million layers, not counting broilers and turkey. Those layers pale compared to the 36 million egg layers that are in the backyards of over 1 million family farms across the country, fully supported by the rural economies and by local market infrastructure, and especially the disconnection from corporate and financial infrastructure. Knowing that, I knew that in order to thrive in this new space and in this new challenges that we're facing, we had to innovate. And so my innovation specifically came in the form of redesigning how we do poultry. We're now leading nationally and internationally in this new design. We are focused on deploying the first large-scale operation in southeastern Minnesota's 20 counties. We have built a large-scale support system and infrastructure for that. I built what is called the Regenerative Agriculture Alliance, so we can coordinate that ecosystem to support those farmers who want to join the system. We are building markets, branding, and at this point, we are leading the discussion on developing a light industrial regenerative branded park in southeastern Minnesota. We need your support for that. These are the kind of initiatives that us immigrants and all those of us who really understood, you know, from the pictures that you have in that equity versus justice in your situation, all we want is a clear fence so we can see through. And, you know, here and then we would like some gates so we can actually walk through that fence as well, because the fence is still a fence, as you know, it's still a barrier. And I can see the other side. We can see clearly how we can thrive. There is over 1,000 farmers in southeastern Minnesota, the 961 number or the 600-plus number in the report. That's a shame, because we are large numbers. 70% of us coming from Latin American countries grew up in agriculture. I met with over 1,100 families between Owatonna, Austin, Faribault, Northfield, and Red Wing, and we found out that about 70% of us would like to farm, but we don't fit in the box, and we are not interested in fitting in that box. We want to farm in a way that takes care of the land, our families especially, our health, our children's health, and the water resources in our regions, the diversity, the immense diversity of this ecology we live in. We want to farm energy. Energy transformation is really our approach, not outputs in terms of bushels per acre, we don't fit in the box. So we will request that, you know, and thank you to the Department of Agriculture, because this is the first time we have been actually fully included in these processes. These listening sessions were critical. Also, thanks, Rod Hamilton, because in the past, this system that I was pioneering and many years ago when we still weren't ready for deployment, I did get a recognition in this very room for those ideas. All I would like is that we move those recognitions into actual structural changes that can allow us to develop this new competitive advantage, not only for rural Minnesota, for agriculture in Minnesota. So thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Thank you very much. A powerful testimony from all three of you. So very much appreciate it. Glad that you were able to come. And again, I apologize to the committee for going over. I think we'll just close the meeting. And if people want to talk to our presenters here, they will be free to do that. Any concluding comments by anyone other than that? Okay. Well, we'll see you then next Tuesday in committee. And thank you very much. And the meeting is adjourned.